Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags with a brisk 30 minutes on the latest in South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast. I'll bring you insightful interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, all in a concise and informative update. It's Thursday, the 2nd of May. Coming up on the program, Johannesburg's big M1 fire and the impact. Are we missing a trick in managing our tourism potential? Asset seizure and lessons learned from the Steinhoff scandal. The Independent Electoral Commission on fake party signatures. And actor John Carney on reprising his Lion King role. You might have been part of this. Power was cut in various parts of Johannesburg after an underground fire broke out along the M1 early Wednesday morning. Now, it is suspected the fire was the result of theft and vandalism. The latter is still under investigation, though. I want to give you more now from Robert Mulaudzi, who speaks for the Johannesburg Emergency Management Services. Robert, welcome and thank you very much for joining us. What is the position then on this Thursday?
Yes, sir. Thank you very much for the opportunity. Yes, we can confirm that we managed to contain the fire last night at around 6:30. The fire was already contained. We left the scene around that time, around 5:30. We actually woke up again this morning around 8:00 in the morning. We're again on site just to conduct an inspection along the tunnel. So we walked through that tunnel just to check whether there's any flare-ups and also to see whether the area, to just to make sure that ensure that the area is safe so that we can be able to hand over the tunnel to our colleagues from City Power. So far, yes, we have done that work, the inspection, and we managed to hand over the area to City Power to now look at as to decide as to when are they going to continue now to start conducting their assessment and also work to try and restore their power in the area.
Are you at this stage able to confirm the initial cause of the fire? There is suggestion that theft, vandalism or even sabotage is considered to be among the primary suspects.
Yes, we are, even though the investigations are still ongoing, however, we with the previous experience which we had in the last fire incident which we had, we suspect that it might be vandalism because it looks like there's a good market for, copper or scrap metals. So there are people who are trying to, remove the cables and then they go sell them for scrap metals. That is the suspicion, for our suspicion, that that might be the cause of the fire, looking at the previous incidents which we had a couple of months ago in the inner city.
This is probably more of a City Power issue, Robert, but it did have a serious impact on the daily operations of businesses and residents in the affected areas, albeit it was a public holiday yesterday.
Yes, it did, especially in terms of the not only the business, but the traffic flow, because if you look at the traffic flow in the area, we managed to almost close that part of the road, almost the whole part of the day yesterday, so of which maybe most of the motorists might have been frustrated, with the traffic congestion in that area. So, but we are happy now that the whole of M1 North is clear, traffic is flowing, and also M1 South also is flowing. It's only one lane which has been partially closed just on that part only to allow the City Power technicians to continue to do their work in the area.
Either yesterday or going forward, would an outage like this impact emergency services' ability to respond to other emergencies within the metro?
No, not really. We like yesterday, we actually had a similar incident in the inner city, of which we did manage to respond to that kind of incident. So from our side, we think that we are capable of making sure that we render effective emergency services. So we should be able to respond to all the emergencies which might occur in the inner city, especially not only in the inner city, but throughout the city of Johannesburg.
Thank you very much for joining us. Robert Molodzi speaks for Johannesburg Emergency Management Services.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Tourism, writes Chifiwe Chivengwa, Tourism Business Council of South Africa's chief executive officer, is, and he calls it, an intricately integrated system of many actors who rely on each other. It's made up of important value chains in the local economy, he says, from tour operators and transport service providers to entertainment and shopping, as well as leisure and recreation, among many others. The big question, of course, is, are we failing to see this? He joins us now, and my first question, Chifiwe, and welcome to you, is there enough coordinated thinking when it comes to managing this very delicate tourism ecosystem?
I do think that we have made some progress when it comes to us being coordinated in delivering the tourism experience. However, I don't think that coordination or that collaboration that we have is good enough to advance the interests of tourism in a way that we want to do. And as an example, you know, we do have many parties that that needs to collaborate together, from Department of Transport, Home Affairs, to International Relations, and many others like local government, that we need to work together to ensure that, you know, tourism thrives. However, you know, if you look at many things that we do, there is still gaps. There are still gaps within the Department of Transport in issuing the licenses for tour operators. There's still gaps in terms of our e-visa system. It's not robust enough or world-class enough. There are still gaps from infrastructure on the local government side in terms of making sure that the roads that leads to attractions are maintained. There is sufficient water for all our establishments to host the guests that are coming in. And of course, issues of electricity are well known by all of us, and hopefully we are getting into a position where we solve those issues. So there are still gaps that exist, especially on things that we can do ourselves to increase tourist numbers into South Africa. E-visa or visa waiver or the immigration regime is still one of the single biggest issue that we have and that we need to solve.
So when you raise these gaps, either with provincial or national government, are you getting answers that are satisfactory?
We always talk about a whole of government approach, which we don't have. So what makes this difficult or not satisfactory for us is that different departments of government don't speak to each other. And when they don't speak to each other, then you have even more gaps. So it becomes very slow. If you talk to the provincial government, you talk to the national, you talk to the local government, there are still gaps there. Department to department, there are still gaps there. As an example, there are gaps between Department of International Relations and Cooperation and Home Affairs as far as visa issuing is concerned. You find that there are offices overseas where, or embassies or high commissions or consulate, where we don't have an official from Home Affairs, and therefore an official from, you know, DERCO has to issue a visa. But there is no proper coordination between that official, because that official doesn't report to Home Affairs, they report to DERCO. So how do you make sure that, you know, there's an agency from both angles whereby one can say, no, I know what needs to be done, I know how, you know, how I need to move, and so forth and so on. So what we find ourselves in is that someone will say, well, but I'm not reporting to Home Affairs. And then Home Affairs will say, but I don't have a staff in that particular office. So those gaps exist. And when they exist, they are frustrating for us. And they frustrate the tourists because they are unable to get the visas on time. We're unable to get, as an example, and I've said these issues around transport permit on time, and we're unable to fix the roads on time to go to the attraction.
And tourists these days, I imagine, are very fickle, particularly international visitors. If they're not getting that seamless service that you're referring to, they're simply going to take their dollars or euros elsewhere.
Absolutely. We work in a very competitive world. There are many countries that have realized that tourism is a low-hanging fruit, and They are doing more than what we are doing. So we always need to keep in mind that, tourists have many other places to choose from. And we need to be top of mind when they are thinking of traveling, to a destination. And we find ourselves really going up the hill, in terms of just convincing air tourists to come to the country because they may not get a visa or they may find the situation on the ground not suitable. So, yes, when we are not coordinated, when we are not working well together, and many people can argue that, we're working well, It's not sufficient. The number of tourists that are coming into this country, as much as they are improving to the 2019 levels, even before COVID, we were getting less than 1% of the world, outbound tourism. If we can just move closer to that 1% of the people that are moving outside of their own, countries to other places, we would have done well and we'll create jobs. So the non-coordinated, level of disaster that we have is not conducive. It doesn't build, tourism. It doesn't build trust. And also, as you said, tourists get frustrated. So we always talk about the number of people that wanted to come to South Africa, but they couldn't come to South Africa because of the visa issues. They just choose another destination. It's easier for them. They go and spend their dollars there. Those economies prosper. And we don't go anywhere. We'll still have issues of unemployment.
Well, thank you very much indeed for the very honest and frank assessment. I appreciate it.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Developments in the Steinhoff scandal, particularly the forfeiture of assets belonging to Marcus Joosten's former partner Bernardine Oudendaal, have set something of a legal precedent in the fight against corporate fraud in South Africa. With the clutter of financial irregularities that came to light after the scandal, the Reserve Bank and other regulatory bodies have been pivotal in untangling and addressing all of this malfeasance. That's a view now from my next guest, who is Danny Naidu, a director at Fairbridge's Wertheim Becker Attorneys. Welcome to you and thank you very much for talking to us. First of all, could you explain to me the legal basis for the forfeiture of assets in this particular instance, particularly in the absence of a criminal conviction?
Yes, so this is a question that has been lurking, especially since the initial assets were frozen and now obviously the forfeiture, especially when you consider Marcus Joosten's death. The exchange control regulations are quite clear and it's quite clearly set out in 22A, B and C of when the South African Reserve Bank can take control of assets and when they can forfeit. And the basis for the forfeiture is that there's a reasonable belief that there was a contravention of these assets. Not only that the flow of the funds were as a result of illicit activity. And that's what has happened here. It's money that flowed into South Africa, into various different entities, and almost guised to be something of clean money, but it actually wasn't. And the exchange control regulations are saying, hold on, this is not legal, this is untoward. There are clear contraventions in respect of our regulations, and based on that, we are forfeiting these amounts, whether held directly or indirectly. It's in regards to who has the position of those funds.
How difficult is it to prove reasonable belief in a case like this? What do you have to present in order for that to happen?
It would have to be looking at the clear direct flow of the money as well as the conduct of the parties under the period that the money was then flowed, and based on that for them to look at the various contraventions that the parties were in fact guilty of, and then as a result go ahead to court and get this preservation. So they froze the assets, they were pending investigations, and from then to now there's now this reasonable belief that these assets were not valid assets, and based on that it has been forfeited, which is very different to other legislation that you have, like the Prevention of Organized Crime, where the state will also say, okay, look, here are these parties, these are the parties that we believe have committed a criminal offense, and based on that, we are freezing assets pending a criminal trial and conviction. But there has to be a conviction before the state can confiscate those funds. The exchange control regulations, quite draconian, but very much alive and well in South Africa, and they implement this process.
If I've understood this correctly, there was another conundrum as well as far as the Oudendaal case was concerned, and that was addressing the issue of asset ownership versus something called beneficiary status in asset forfeiture. How do you make a differentiation between the two?
So beneficial ownership is where a lot of these assets were in her name and she was having a direct benefit. Indicative of that is obviously the properties as well as the application that that went all the way to the SCA that she had launched, where she needed reasonable expenses to be paid for and basically her upkeep to be maintained. But when you look at the flow of the money, and the exchange control regulations are quite clear under sections 22A, C and B, is that the money doesn't necessarily have to be in the possession of the accused or the perpetrator. It's just whoever's possession it is that flowed from some sort of contravention. So yes, she had beneficial ownership, but now that these assets have been forfeited, that beneficial ownership argument goes away. And now the question is, does she have legal standing to go and contest this under a review process? Because the exchange control regulations are saying, well, actually, she never really was entitled to that money and she never really owned that money. So that is something that's there, which will be quite interesting to see how it's dealt with and the remedies that will be taken. It would probably have to be the entities that held these assets, which would then have to go and possibly look at review proceedings. But for her to do it, it would be quite difficult, especially when you look at her being unsuccessful in her application to the SCA for her expenses to be paid for.
How difficult would it be then for her to contest this and seek the kind of recourse that she would want?
I would say it's going to be quite difficult, and it's going to be quite a lengthy, costly exercise. I don't know what her other means are financially and the type of legal advice that she would get. The other difficulty that she faces is that money wasn't really held by her, it was held by her indirectly and flowed from other entities. So for the likes of his trusts, those would probably be the correct entities that would have the proper legal standing to try and review this forfeiture that has now taken place. I don't know if she will be quite successful in a review under these circumstances.
So what happens then to those forfeited assets once they are transferred to the National Revenue Fund? What's the process there and how long would they stay there for?
So that would be to the benefit of the fund, and that would then be utilized towards expenses for states, you know, government officials, upkeep, almost looking at like what your tax money is really doing. It's basically money that the state is now entitled to hold that they can use in respect of payments for regulated bodies.
Is there broader impact then in terms of legal precedent on corporate fraud prevention strategy in South Africa? In other words, what changes as a result of this?
So look, Jeremy, you would know, and it's been all over the news when you look at state capture, when you look at where corporate South Africa is, when you look at what's really in the public domain with individuals, entities, banks, etc. This is already a discussion point that a lot more people are speaking about and a lot more people are engaging in. I think where the difference would be is, I mean, these regulations have been around forever. So has other legislation. So they've always been there. It's just that now it's more in the public domain of how they're being utilized and what the actual impact is. I think something like this is definitely going to make South African individuals that have entities and are dealing with cross-border transactions, for them to be a much more alive to how they are actually dealing with their funds and to be alive of the possibility of contraventions and to seek proper legal advice in terms of their day-to-day conduct. Because the result of them not doing that and the result of them being in some form of contravention is going to have an adverse effect, as you can see here. And I think based on this and based on the severity of the impact on her specifically in terms of her livelihood and the value of the assets that have now been forfeited, I think a lot more people are going to be a bit more cautious about, you know, not ticking all the right boxes and trying to disguise the flow of money.
And I'm going to thank you very much indeed for that explanation, Dahini Naidu. I appreciate it.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
The Electoral Commission is calling for police to expedite its investigation into reports that Jacob Zuma's Zimkhonto Wesizwe party allegedly forged the signatures it submitted to the commission during the candidate nomination process. From the IEC, joining us now is the Deputy Chief Electoral Commissioner, Masego Shiburi. Welcome and thank you very much for talking to us. Why is the IEC making this call to police?
Jeremy, good afternoon. Two things. A party in the position of MK that needed to contest the election and it does not have any representation needed to have done two things. The first was to capture the ID numbers of supporters on the online portal that the IEC has made available for that purpose. The portal enables us to verify if the ID number exists and if that ID number belongs to a registered voter, because only registered voters may support a party to stand. Secondly, the party ought to have uploaded the signatures of the ID numbers, of the holders of the ID numbers, onto an online portal in order to qualify to contest. The law doesn't require of the commission to verify that the ID belongs to a voter. It must take it on face value. And if the ID supplied are linked to ID numbers and they meet the requisite quota for each of the region, the commission is lawfully bound to confirm that party as having met the requirements to contest.
I'm guessing that because we are now 27 days away from the poll, time is of the essence as far as the investigation is concerned.
Indeed, time is of the essence, but on our part, we can confirm that the party has met the requirements in both the requirements in terms of the law as it stands. However, as it relates to the issue of signatures, whether they were falsified or whether they were legitimate signatures of the voters, on that respect, the commission has no repository of signatures or database of signatures, and therefore it can verify that the signatures are indeed correct.
So what then are the legal and procedural consequences?
The legal and procedural consequences will be that if there is a case made out and if it can be proven that the signatures were forged, we'll have to then make an assessment. The number of signatures that were forged and whether they disqualify the party in a region or in a specific election.
So the potential impact on the upcoming election if these allegations of signature forgery are proven true could be serious then, because obviously there would be pushback from the MK party.
Indeed, the implications are dire, both on the perception of freeness and fairness of election, but also dire for the party concerned.
Have you had any comeback from the SAPS regarding its investigation so far?
No, we have not yet received any feedback, but they appreciate the seriousness with which electoral offences ought to be treated because they are time bound.
Just one other issue before I let you go. There has been some noise around special voting processes for people over the age of 60 and those unable to vote on election day. Where is the confusion?
Okay. The confusion is as follows. It is a legally prescribed process. It doesn't qualify a person on the basis of age. All that it does is to say if a person has a physical condition and owing to that condition they are unable to physically present at the voting station, the commission must make means to accommodate that person so that they can vote in a place where they are confined. So what we sought to correct is to say a person does not have to be 60 years and above to qualify for special vote. They could be younger and have a physical condition that militates against them going to a voting station. So the correction is that anyone who knows that they will be away from their voting district on voting day can send an SMS to 32249. They send an ID number there. They will be approved for special vote at their voting stations. Those who are unable to physically go to a voting station may cause an application to be made on their behalf, and we will visit those at the place of confinement on the 27th and the 28th. So a special vote is not by default available to everyone who is over 60 years, because then you're treating people as basket cases on the basis only of age.
Well, someone who's in that age zone, Masego Shiburi, I'm very pleased that you said that. Thank you very much indeed, Deputy Chief Electoral Commissioner. I do appreciate your time. This is MoneyWeb at Midday.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
And finally, among others, South Africa will be represented by the actor John Carney in Disney's Mufasa, The Lion King. The first trailer of the star-studded cast of Mufasa, The Lion King, released this week. Dr. Carney is with me now. John Carney, a very warm welcome. So how does it feel to reprise this iconic role? And I wonder what this character means to you personally.
Guillermo, you remember Guillermo in Benson? this American series, he used to be Rafiki in the first animation. And after that, many different sort of productions on stage were staged all over the world, actually, Europe, Asia, Australia, New Zealand, London, New York. In fact, on Broadway, it just celebrated 25 years on Broadway. Mm. So when the first Lion King, I got a call from John Favreau. He said to me, I'd love you to do the honor of voicing Rafiki. I said, you know, when you meet Americans on Broadway, on Hollywood, they say a lot of things. I just put it one ear out the other. Then I'm telling my son, I said, I met a guy called John Favreau. He said, you mean the John Favreau? I said, yes. He wants me to voice Rafiki. And my son said, so? Do you know John Favreau? I said, nah, I don't know John Favreau. So I agreed. Yeah. So the first thing we got together, we talked. And I asked a question like, okay, where are these lions? Are they in Africa, trekking from the Kenya, Zambia, into the northern part of Mpumalanga, into Kruger National Park and back, or are they in a zoo in Oakland? He said, well, they're in Africa. I said, therefore, they are African lions. Mm. I said, yes, okay, we agreed. And then he asked me what was my approach to Rafiki, because he's kind of like been played a mischievous sort of monkey, you know. I said, I see him as the Chief Justice who inaugurates new presidents, announce the incoming heir to the kingdom of Pride Rock. Yes, he's quite wise with wise cracks, but he is like the custodian of Pride Rock and all the kings that had predated Mufasa. He said, that's one we're going with for. So we did the first one, and the reception was mind-blowing. I've never been in a movie that makes over $1 billion income. Mm. And knowing, of course, that you got a tiny little percentage, Jeremy, a tiny little. It does become not very tiny at the end of the day.
Yeah, I'm sure, yeah.
So then the second one now, I got a call from Barry Jenkins. I said, I got Barry Jenkins, Moonlight, Oscar Award winning. I said, hi, this is John Carney. He says, Dr. Carney, would you do me an honor again? We're doing Mufasa, the prequel, The Lion King. Would you be available to voice Rafiki again? I was thinking at the back of my mind, nah, I'm too busy with Jeremy in South Africa. I have another project. I said, yes, of course. It has become such an incredible role and a challenge. It's easy to be on camera and play a role because they bank on your face and your reputation and the box office pool. But when you do voice and you have to animate this voice and you have to give it an identity and people have to identify the role with the tonation of your voice and everything, so that when they see you, they see the cartoon or the animated character. So, and my approach simply is, I'm an elder. And I see him as an elderly within Pride Rock, a confidant to Mufasa and Simba and generations to come, a consultant on issues of there's a child born, take it up to Pride Rock and introduce it to the animal kingdom. So that's my relationship as an elder. And it fits well when you are 80, doesn't it, Jeremy?
John,
suddenly you play a role of elderly people.
Well, John, I'm not quite at 80 yet, but I know exactly what you're saying because I'm heading there very quickly. Let me ask you this question. Given the global impact of The Lion King, how do you view the importance of this role in the new narrative from a cultural perspective?
Number one, what somebody said about the Lion King is that it does something a little more than just entertain kids and elders that don't want to grow up, who are still ardent followers of the Lion King sort of brand. Then it teaches the young children continuity, the circle of life. That when Mufasa died in the first one, I mean, it was distraught. I know I was in a cinema when people cried in Kodak in Hollywood on the opening night at the death. But in the end, when Simba emerged, they saw the continuity of the same life. So kids may be able to handle death in the more if they relate to the continuation of Mufasa, Simba, whoever follows. In that way, it becomes an incredible, important role within the entertainment industry. And also the fact that, you know, kingdoms, and Africa is just kingdoms. That, for me, is almost like telling the story of Africa. For instance, in this particular one, there is the issue that Rafiki had a twin, and he's also in his journey searching for the twin, which makes me remember that within the African culture, days ago, that when twins were born, they had to get rid of the other twin because they said it is the mirror of the other twin's soul, may even influence to bad things. Thank God we grew out of that, and that practice was abandoned. So it made me remember that when Rafiki always talks about, I had a twin, I don't know what happened, because it was a kid. So in that way, it has an impact on the global consciousness of relationship between us and nature. I would wish that when these trophy hunters from America and Europe come to South Africa and shoot at these canned lions, collecting them, I hope they see Mufasa's face before they pull the trigger and stop. I hope they see Simba's face before they pull the trigger and stop. It gives these lions and these animals a different identity in partnership as custodians of the earth with the human beings.
And I am going to leave it there. Dr. John Carney, thank you very much indeed. And I do know that South African audiences are really looking forward to this reprisal. Thank you so much indeed. And finally, on our last online poll, security vetting the SABC editor, I asked you if it was necessary, sinister, or if more clarity was needed on the situation, and around half of our respondents saying the development is ominous. Today, relating to an earlier interview with the Tourism Business Council, what about our tourism potential in South Africa? Do you believe we are leveraging it sufficiently, or are we missing a trick, or that more work is needed from South African tourism? If you have a view on that, go to MoneyWeb on Twitter, X, or our LinkedIn page. MoneyWeb at midday. We are live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.